Oh, the car from Carvana's here. Well, will you look at that? It's exactly what I ordered. Like, precisely. It would be crazy if there were any catches. But there aren't, right?
Right. Because that's how car buying should be. With Carvana, you get the car you want. Choose delivery or pickup. And a week to love it or return it.
Buy your car today with
Carvana.
Delivery or pickup fees may apply. Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at Carvana.com.
Hello everybody, and welcome to a new episode of Gaming in the Wild, a video games podcast about games from the creative side of the tracks, from indie to AAA. My name's John, I'm your host. I'm recording on a rainy, blustery, grey Saturday afternoon out in Reykjavik, Iceland, as always. But I've been playing a lot of games this week. It's been a bit of a grey and blustery week in general. So it's getting into that autumn season, which is some peak gaming time for me, actually. When you don't want to go out and there's no distractions, it's a good time to sit down and tuck into some video games. That's what I've been doing. And probably of no surprise to anyone listening, if you are a regular listener of the show, or at least if you've listened to the last couple of episodes, I've mostly been playing Starfield. That game still has its hooks deep into me. I did like an hour-long episode about it last week. And the week before that, I gave initial first impression. So I'm going to carry on talking about Starfield this week. There are some things that I did not touch upon in the previous episodes. I didn't even talk about space combat, shipbuilding, mission structures, base building, and all of that kind of thing. So I'm going to touch on the systems that I didn't talk about yet, even having done an hour-long episode about that game. There is just so much to discuss. So if you are playing Starfield, you can look forward to that. I'm also going to talk about a few spoilery things for the first time, so I'm going to drop a strong spoiler warning and delve into some of that meaty stuff about the story, the main quest, the faction quests, and a few of my favourite side quests that I found so far that I would consider spoilable. So there'll be some Starfield chat today that is fine for the uninitiated or the curious or people that aren't playing the game. And there will also be some Starfield chat for those who are playing the game and are neck deep in it like I am. So something for everyone, I hope. But before we get to all of that, this was a very news-heavy week. We have had a bunch of game announcements, we've had two directs, and I haven't done the September Games Roundup that I normally do. Starfield took over so much that I just completely clean forgot about it, so thank you to Dovetail in the show's Discord for reminding me. So I'm going to do that as well. But before all of that stuff, I have a few new games that I've received codes for that I'm going to add to the podcast slate to cover in the future. And there are some pretty interesting ones here, actually. Two separate people reached out to me and talked to me about this game. It's a game that I had noticed, but it has stealth elements, so I was going to pass it over. But two different people reached out and said, you should play this. This is a John game. This has got archaeology, and it's got language deciphering, and it's got a cool setting and a nice look, and it's Chants of Sennar. You might have heard about this one or seen it in a previous Nintendo Direct, but this is a game with a stealth element where you are creeping through some kind of cult compound, as I understand it. It's a high fantasy kind of thing. It has a really nice Sable-esque art style. And based on the recommendations from two friends whose opinions I trust, so I have downloaded that game on the Xbox, and I'm going to be playing that one after the Starfield fever lifts, and I'll be covering that in the future. I also got a code for Mythforce. This is a game that was in a direct. I can't remember which one exactly. But it's a third-person game that seems to be focused on combat. But it has a very cool art style. It has that He-Man Saturday morning cartoon art style that I haven't really seen in many games, actually. So I was just curious to check it out from a visual point of view. I don't know what the gameplay is like, but it's intriguing enough to want to check out for sure. The third of the four games I have new codes for is Nor play with your food. That's Nour. Not sure if I'm pronouncing it right. It could be Nour. Nour, play with your food. I got an email about this one, and it's a strange-looking physics game based on food, where you're literally playing with your food. So you get different kinds of food that you can spawn into worlds, and it looks like some bizarre mischief. I don't really know what the game of it all is, but the trailer showed food flying around and absolute chaos unfolding with all kinds of stuff spawning in. So I'm curious to try that one. That's on PS5. And the final new game added to the podcast slate is The Pale Beyond, which has been out for a while on PC. It's from fellow Traveller, who published Citizen Sleeper and lots of other good games. And it just got a console release, so I was able to snag a Switch code for that one. It's a choice-based game about leading a crew who've become stranded in the Arctic on an old-style sailing ship. I've had some heavy recommends for this one, too, from various people. So The Pale Beyond, I have it on Switch. So Chance of Sanaa, Mythforce, Nour, Play With Your Food, and The Pale Beyond have all been added to the list of games that I will notionally cover if I ever get done with Starfield. So expect to hear me talking about those in the future. One more game in this section. It's a game I've covered before. It is Solar Ash. It was the follow-up to Hyper Light Drifter, developed by Heart Machine. It came out in December of 2021. It made my Games of the Year list that year and even cracked the top five. I really liked it. It's published by Annapurna Interactive. It got a console release for Switch and Xbox. So I dropped a line to the PR and said I'd like to test out those ports, and I'll talk about it on the show, which I will do right now. So this is a great game. It's a dark, slick, rapid sci-fi game, and it shares the cool sensibility of Hyperlight Drifter, which I thought was pristine in its art design, its color palette, and these themes of illness and unwellness and dread that permeated Hyperlight Drifter in the most cool way. It's really tender, very human somehow. There's lots of imagery of blood. In Hyperlight Drifter, the main character will occasionally cough up blood after a boss fight. You can tell that they are unwell. There is a famous story that the lead developer, Alex Preston, is actually chronically ill. And so the fact that illness is woven into these games in such a cool way is somewhat autobiographical, even if they are far-flung high sci-fi games. But Solar Ash is a game with a skating mechanic. So you skate across clouds, you skate through broken sci-fi vistas, you rail grind, you strike enemies as you are doing so. It's just quickly pap, 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 and they're dead, so it doesn't slow you down. It's a game about motion. The premise is that you are a void runner who is traveling into a black hole to try and destroy the black hole and stop their home world from being sucked in and broken apart. They are chasing in a team of void runners who have gone cold, gone quiet. And as you move through these different biomes, you realize that there are many smashed worlds inside this void, the ultra void, and you have to traverse them all with this very fluid traversal, picking up story crumbs, trying to find your lost colleagues. There are also bosses that are like Shadow of the Colossus style bosses. There are lots and lots of little mini speed trials where you have to strike a node, and then you have to strike a few more before the time runs out to open up gateways to move forward. So it's got a little bit of a neon white speed running kind of feel to it, but the visual style is absolutely arresting. It's purples and midnight blues and pinks. It's neon. Very, very cool. Very, very contemporary. It's got that Sayonara Wild Hearts, like Twilight Digital Dream feeling to the whole thing. I absolutely loved the game. I have reviewed it before. I did test out both the ports, and sad to say, the Switch port doesn't really get it done. But this was a game that came out on PS5, so it's a next-gen game that's been backward engineered to fit onto the Switch. It takes a huge visual hit. The crisp, clean lines of the art style turn into this kind of mangled pixel junk on the Switch screen. I tweeted out a comparison between an Xbox screenshot and a Switch screenshot, and honestly, it just looks like a different character model. The Switch version also stutters a lot. The text is very small. So I say don't play this one on the Switch. It's a compromised version. However, I did also email the PR about this, and I said this version is a little crushed. So they sent me an Xbox code, which makes me sad if they're throwing out that many codes. I worry that not enough journalists are interested. Normally, codes are quite hard to come by for a little podcast like mine. But I was able to get an Xbox code, so I did test that too. And I can say that on Series S, X rather. This was a flawless port, exactly the same as the PS5 version. Crisp, beautiful models, really cool art style, just visually perfect. Great soundtrack too, dark electronic soundtrack. So I would say, if you are going to play this one, PS5, PC, Xbox, all great. It is now on Game Pass. So if you have access to Game Pass on a PC or a console, try Solar Ash. And I would say, get through the first area. It will take you about half an hour. If you feel turned off by the speedrunning aspects, just stick with it just a little bit and get through that that first area and see if it opens up to you. There are some very, very cool moments in the game. The story is great, and it really, really lands the plane. It's a tight game as well. I think I finished it in 8 or 9 hours. It's one of those games that doesn't outstay its welcome, and it's actually a rare game that I wished was a little longer or had a little more side questy stuff to give me just an excuse to stay in that world. Very, very cool. Moody, mesmerizing, satisfying, really good length. That's Solar Ash. So moving on to talk about a little bit of news, I'm going to whip through these fairly quickly. I did not watch the State of Play or the Nintendo Direct at the time I was working, but I did scan the news. And so in Nintendo's Direct, they happened on the same day, isn't that crazy? Like, there's only a few Directs a year, and two of them were on the same day. But Nintendo's Direct was focused on more remasters and remakes. Paper Mario's Thousand Year Door is coming to Switch. I have not played that game, so I'm quite pleased about that news. I may well pick it up, depending on price. If it's 50 quid, then no. They're also remaking or remastering Luigi's Mansion 2, Mario vs. Donkey Kong, Super Mario RPG, which we knew about already, but which is coming out soon, I believe. And they announced a few new things for Switch Online, F-Zero 99, a multiplayer variant of F-Zero. That's pretty cool. So lots and lots of classic Nintendo games coming to Switch. It is what people have been asking for, even if it's not Wind Waker for some reason. So lots of classic Nintendo coming to Switch. The big news, though, was that Dave the Diver is coming to Switch, one of the indie hits of the year. It's coming on the 25th of October, and a demo is available now. There's also a demo for Gunbrella, if you're curious about that one. So a couple top indie game demos out on the Switch as well. The Sony Direct had a big announcement about Final Fantasy VII Remake Part 2, which got a release date on February 24th next year. That gives me some good impetus to finish the first remake. I'm right at the finishing line, but for some reason I just keep slipping off it. But this gives me the reason that I need to finish it and make an episode about that game, actually. I did play the original Final Fantasy way back in the 90s, so it's been quite a sentimental time. I do have some thoughts about that one, so expect that over the winter months. There was also more Spider-Man 2 hype. That game is looking very fun. I played Miles Morales a couple years ago and absolutely loved it, much more than I thought I would. So I will play Spider-Man 2 at some point, even if it's not on release. That's coming out soon. We also saw more of Bennett Foddy's Baby Steps. This is a weird-looking game. If you know Bennett Foddy, you'll know he made a game called Getting Over It that focused entirely on incredibly frustrating movement mechanics, where you have to claw your way up an unwieldy hill with your bare hands, and you fall down a lot, you lose all your progress a lot. It seems like an art piece about player frustration, almost. He's making a sequel of sorts, and in Baby Steps, it's a walking simulator in a way that we've never seen before, in that it actually simulates the act of walking, placing your foot, trying to carry your weight, presumably falling down a lot. Weird-looking game. Definitely intriguing. That's coming out next summer. There was also news of an Avatar game. I'm sure that some people out there are very excited about this. I'm not an Avatar guy, and so this has really just passed me by. But Avatar is coming out on December 7th. And finally, there was a little bit of interesting DLC news that I'm going to include here for Tales of Arise, like an excellent JRPG that came out 2 years ago. I've dabbled in it. I've played the first 10 hours. Had a really good time with it. But JRPGs being what they are, with all of that grind and all of that repetition, I just slipped off it. I can never seem to really get through a full-fat JRPG without just getting bored by the JRPG model. But for those of you who like Tales of Arise and did see the end, there is a DLC coming for you, so that's good news for fans of Tales of Arise. And the last thing on the agenda in the news section before we get to some Starfield chat is that I forgot to do the September release roundup. I've started doing these at the start of the month, Just to run through some of the games that I'm interested in and some of the big games, some of the smaller indie games too that have caught my eye. Some people in the Discord helped me in maintaining a spreadsheet of all of the interesting games that are coming up, and I have plucked out a few to talk about here. It's actually a pretty busy month. There are quite a few indie games coming out, which I'm glad to see. I feel like this year has been more about the AAA games for the first time since I've been doing this podcast. I've always felt like there were some cream of the crop indies that floated to the top of my Games of the Year long list pretty early in the year. There are a couple this year, but it's pretty AAA heavy right now, so it's nice to see some new indie games coming out that we can try and see if there are any hidden gems there. The first one I've talked about already, Chants of Sennar, by Focus Entertainment. That one came out on the 5th of the month. That is out on Switch, PC, and console. It's the stealth cult language deciphering adventure game. On the 6th, Starfield, of course. The big day for Starfield. On the 7th of this month, The Many Pieces of Mr. Koo came out. This is a whimsical point-and-click adventure with quite a surreal-looking story. Check that one out if you enjoy point-and-clicks, because it looks like something a little different. On the 8th, Fae Farm came out. This is a cute farming game that a lot of people were excited about online. It's a pretty low-stakes one. I checked out the Metacritic score for this one. It's in the 70s. People said that they really like the grindy farming mechanics, but that they felt if you're a Stardew person who likes the RPG elements, the romancing and all that kind of stuff, they said there wasn't so much of that in Fae Farm, so it depends on what kind of farming game you like. But if you do just like the farming, maybe that's one to check out. On the 11th, Mythforce came out. That's the He-Man-style game that I've discussed already. On the 12th was The Isle Tide Hotel from Wales Interactive, who are a bastion of FMV games. I don't play many FMV games unless they have the name Sam Barlow attached to them, but Wales Interactive churns them out. This one is a detective game set in a mysterious hotel where you are investigating a cult, and it has cast members from Game of Thrones and The Witcher in it. So it seems like Wales Interactive must be doing well. They keep putting out so many of these FMV games, and they're really waving the flag for the genre. If you're into it, The Isle Tide Hotel, it's a slight tongue twister, is out now. On the 13th, Gunbrella came out. It's been quite well received. It is by Doinksoft, possibly the worst developer name I've ever heard, the makers of Gato Roboto, published by Devolver. This is the noir punk pixel action adventure where you have a little umbrella that also acts as a gun, so you can float and shoot your way through 2D levels. Seems to have an interesting story. You find it at the start of the game as a murder weapon that has been used to kill someone you love, and you take that weapon and go on a trail of revenge to try and find the killer. People are praising the gameplay and saying that it's quite a snappy play, quite easy to get through. Gunbrella, a demo for that one, is out on Switch. Bringing us up to date, Solar Ash came out on the 14th, which I've talked about already, and now looking forward to the rest of the month. On the 18th, Gloomhaven is coming out. I'm not familiar with Gloomhaven, but a quick Google revealed that it is one of the most popular tabletop games, one of the best-selling tabletop games out there. This is a tactical RPG based on that board game. The visual style is pretty cool. It looks like painted miniatures that you'll be familiar with, but in an animated style. So they have these cool resting animations, idle animations, and the combat, turn-based combat, is like animated painted miniatures. If you're into Gloomhaven or turn-based games, maybe worth checking out. On the 19th, The Lies of P is coming. This is the RPG Souls-like based on the classic story of Pinocchio. Probably a pass for me as a non-Souls-like fan, but people are saying that it is Bloodborne-esque in spirit if you're into that kind of thing. A community addition to the spreadsheet here is a game called Spirited Thief that I hadn't heard of. I had to Google this one. It's the first game by Koi Snowman. This is an interesting take on turn-based as well. This one is a turn-based stealth game where you have a little ghost friend that you can send forward into a level to scout, and then you then have to plan your moves through that level to evade being found and to commit robberies. So Spirited Thief could be an interesting one for you if you'd like a stealthy twist on a turn-based gameplay. On the 19th and 20th, two big games that aren't for me, Mortal Kombat 1 on the 19th, which has been getting very good reviews, and Payday 3 on the 20th, the multiplayer FPS heist game that has a third game now, and apparently does gangbusters and has loads of people playing it. I've only seen the clown masks, and I've never really dipped into it, but Payday 3 is coming out. On the 22nd is one of my bold ones here, one of the ones that I'm really excited about. I actually picked this in one of my Fantasy Critic Leagues. Minico's Night Market, the long-in-development adventure merchant simulation inspired by games like Animal Crossing, but with a stronger emphasis on story, crafting, and exploration, it says here. This is by Meowza Games. It has a very, very cool art style, very cute. It's being published by Humble. It's coming on Switch and then all of the other consoles later. So Minico's Night Market, I will definitely be playing on the 22nd. On the 23rd, a really, really big one for me personally and for a lot of people, Cyberpunk 2077, Phantom Liberty, the DLC, starring Idris Elba, and the Cyberpunk 2.0 version, which features reworked skill trees, reworked car combat, some of the stuff we've seen about the changes that are coming in this final form of Cyberpunk are just insane. So that one's coming out on the 23rd, and I'm really, really excited for it. I still have loose ends I want to tie up in Cyberpunk in my first playthrough. I didn't get any of the alternative endings and things like that, so I'm kind of saving it. But I do sometimes still jump into Cyberpunk, which is not my usual play style, but something about that world is just so, so good. It is one of the best open-world RPGs that I have played, even given all of its baggage. It's just a stellar game. So if you've never played Cyberpunk, this is the time to do it. The 23rd for the 2.0 and the Phantom Liberty DLC. And finally, rounding out the month, on the 25th, we have Cocoon by Geometric, the first game that they have made, published by Annapurna, coming out on all the consoles and PC, famously developed partly by Jeppe Carlsson, the lead gameplay designer of Limbo and Inside. This is a very cool-looking top-down puzzle game where you find these globes or spheres and you can move in or out of them to go deeper or further out of different worlds to solve puzzles that have knock-on effects to those other layers. So it's a very cool looking layered puzzle game with a lovely art style, and the fact that Jeppe Carlsson is involved is enough for me to want to check it out. So that's the September roundup. Just to go through the highlights for me, I'm definitely going to be playing Chants of Sennar, Mythforce, Gumbrella, Minico's Night Market, and Cyberpunk, and I will definitely be playing Cocoon as well. So those are my September highlights. And a big thank you to the community and to Dovetail True for helping me maintain this spreadsheet. It's quite a lot to keep track of all the games that are coming out, so I really appreciate the help. It makes the show better, and I think it's fun for people to hear about all of these games. A few gems here that I hadn't heard of before. And before we get into the Starfield chat, let me just finish this section by saying this is a patron-supported show. We hit 50 patrons, finally. I've been hoping that we would this year. It was my loose, self-set target. So thank you very much to all of the patrons of the show, and especially to Ray Bosley, who was that 50th patron. I always have a nice chat with people who sign up on Patreon. So I had a nice chat with Ray down in Australia, I believe. If you would like to join the Patreon, you get a bunch of bonus episodes, you get access to the show's cozy Discord community, and a bunch of other extras as well. You can do so at patreon.com/gamingintheWild, and I'll put a link to that in the description. Click through to support the show for $1 a month, get those bonus episodes, and join the show's community. Big thank you to all of my patrons, I really appreciate you all. Thanks very much for showing support, for spurring me on, for sharing this podcast out on the internet, and rating it, reviewing it, recommending it to friends. I really appreciate all of that stuff, so thanks a lot to all my patrons. I did a little Starfield stream to celebrate. I know that people like to drop by and see me stream. I'm not a natural streamer, but I do it sometimes. I'm going to try and stream more so that we've hit 50 patrons, and I want to say thanks to the community and create space for people to drop by and hang out. So look out for more Starfield streams over on Twitch as well. And with all of that said, it's time for the third week in a row to talk about Bethesda's huge sci-fi RPG, Starfield. And somehow there is a lot more to say about this game. I talked about it, as I have said, briefly 2 weeks ago, after 3 hours. Last week we did an hour-long, spoiler-free deep dive, talking about factions, talking a lot about combat, talking about this world at large, but there's still much more to talk about. I've now been playing this game for 2 weeks, almost to the exclusion of everything else. The only other game that I've literally picked up has been Solar Ash, just to test those ports. but there's so much I didn't talk about yet, so I'm going to touch on some of that today. I'm going to talk about the missions, the things that you actually spend your time doing in this game. There are several different tiers of missions, from fully involved story stuff down to deck collection, little activities, just really, really tiny side quests. And then there are different types in between as well. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the structure of this game. It's quite interesting, really, how developers structure open world games and keep your interest. And Starfield has more to do than almost any game that I've played. It might not all be top tier, fully finished, polished mechanics and systems, but there is just so much here that you feel like it almost never runs out, even after 2 weeks of intensive play. That includes shipbuilding and base building and space combat, none of which I talked about last week, so I'll talk about a little bit of that as well. Then I will drop a spoiler warning and go into detail on the main quest, or at least where I am up to, right before the last mission, and a couple of amazing side quests that I did that just blew my mind, and story quests too, actually. I just wanted to talk through some of the spoiler-full content. But don't worry, I will drop a firm spoiler warning before we do that. So in Starfield, you pick up missions in quite a variety of ways, actually. You can get them from the open world, you find them from slates, which are like tablets that you find on people or in the environment. You can get missions from those. You can overhear missions, which I absolutely love. So as you're walking around the streets, you might hear a pair of civilians chit-chatting. They might be talking about, so my sister checked into this rehab facility. She was a spacer and she wanted to leave. So it's a criminal rehab on a space station. And then a little mission will pop on your UI and it will say, visit the rehab facility. You can hold down a button to select that immediately as your active mission. If not, it goes into the mission system, which has several tabs on it. The main quest and the faction quests are the top tier of missions in this game. That is curated story content. That is the meat of the game, the things that really move the story forward. That includes the Constellation quest, which is to do with artifacts, to do with exploration. The UC, the United Colonies, which is about being a Vanguard member, helping out settlers who are struggling out in the world. It has a lot of intrigue in it. Then you have Freestar, where you are a deputy for the Outback Cowboy guys. The Red Fleet mission, which is a pirate fleet that you can get involved with. And Ryujin Industries, which is a corporation that you can apply for a job at and get pulled into some corporate matters. But outside of those, I don't always play those, because those are ones where you have to... It's like watching a movie. You sit down, you settle in, you get your snacks, you get your drink, and you know that you are in for a ride. You're going to be talking to people, traveling the galaxy. It's quite a high-commitment style of play. It is the main game. But one of the reasons that I've played so much of this is that you don't have to play that way. So you don't have to be involved in these deep, multi-part story quests with big rewards and high stakes, dramatic scripted stories and intrigue between factions and deep world building, you know, talking to presidents, talking to governments and all of that kind of stuff. You can also just do a few chill missions and relax. And some nights I've just played 3 hours of Starfield almost doing nothing, in inverted commas. And I really love that there are so many ways to do nothing in this game. So after the main Constellation quests and the faction story quests, we have four different tabs here. One of them is Miscellaneous, which is a funny name for it. I think these would traditionally be called side quests. These are things where you meet someone out in the world who asks you to do something. There's a little bit of voice acting, there's a little bit of story to it, but it's just lightweight stuff. This involves things like getting involved with gangs in Neon, getting involved with taking out one gang for another gang, disposing of evidence for a fixer that you meet in a nightclub, going to a warehouse, finding a murder weapon, getting rid of it for money and XP, delivering flyers for the unionist shopkeeper, which I really enjoyed doing, trying to create a bit of solidarity between these shopkeepers that are under the auspices of a protection racket, that kind of thing, and delivering contraband between shady people on different planets. So these are low-stress, miscellaneous quests, sometimes with one or two steps to each one, but they don't impact any of the major stuff in the game, and so they're just fun. They help you to build out this world, and there are loads and loads of side quests to pick up. I think I've got 15 complete and 10 open on my tabs currently. The next one is missions. These are almost intentionally time fillers. So missions you can pick up from a mission board. And there are mission boards everywhere. You can even build them in certain places if you want to have one nearby. But you will find them at civilian outposts, just these procedurally generated bases out in the world. You will find them at settlements. You will find them at trade authority buildings. You will find them in spaceports. So if you want something to do that doesn't involve a lot of story or that kind of thing, you can pick up missions. You can just run bounties. Some of them are bounties. You just have to go and find a target and either persuade them to stand down or deal with them. There are transport quests where you're hauling goods or people between two planets. There are supply quests, which sort of encourage you to set up mining operations and get involved with base building in order to generate like a shit ton of lithium or a shit ton of iron and send it to somewhere that needs it. You can set up cargo links between the hold of one of your outposts on a planet that is just churning materials out of the ground and then set it to just be beamed somewhere. So that encourages you to mess with the base building. So all of these things are just fun ways to spend time in Starfield without committing to anything major. So I will often pick up a mission. Like if I see a mission board, I will take a look. My favorite's the bounties where you just go and kill someone because I know what I'm doing. I think for transport quests, my ship doesn't have a huge amount of passenger space so far. So I guess what these missions do is make you interact with the different systems of the game. Supply quests push you to work with outposts, which the game doesn't really do. Transport quests push you to get a bigger ship, maybe engage with shipbuilding. But the bounties are just simple combat missions. But there is a never-ending supply of missions for you to do. So there's loads and loads of those, and you can just pick them up at will. There are also activities. These are even lower down on the tiers. These tend to be a little more ephemeral. Maybe a companion wants a heart-to-heart, or just to give you a sandwich, or all of the things that companions periodically want to do in this game. This is where you'll be reminded that you have to do that. If you do overhear NPCs talking in the street and pick up a little mission, it's probably an activity, and you can find it in the Activities tab if you want to do that mission. They can be very simple. Go and talk to someone, find out what is wrong. They will usually have a problem, like they need to collect the wheat because their family is hungry. You go and collect the wheat, give it to them, you get your reward. Sometimes there's knock-on, and there's a few more steps, you know. I think one of my activities that was fun was helping out the homeless community in Aquila City, who were having supply issues and weren't getting their usual contributions from local business owners. So I had to go and talk to those business owners. And again, this was a very clever way to make me walk around Aquila City and get the lay of the land. I found out where the Trade Authority building was, which is very handy. They are the merchants that have the most money to buy all your junk. And I had missed its existence in Aquila City. So this little activity actually helped me out significantly. And I've been back to that Trade Authority a lot of times since. And this is also the tab where the Radiant quests go. So when you land on a planet, you can go and find a civilian outpost. Each planet or moon tends to have two or three things that you can go and visit, like an abandoned mech factory or an abandoned... If it says abandoned, it's probably going to be occupied by spacers or pirates or Varun zealots. And you might just clear it out and get a bunch of loot, which is a fun way to spend time. But sometimes you'll find a bunch of settlers who are having a problem with local wildlife and they want you to go and kill something, or scientists that are being bullied by spacers that will send you off to clear a base and get rid of those spacers. So there's all kinds of stuff that you can do here that's just very, very lightweight. And I think it should feel more lightweight than it does. Like, I think it shouldn't be interesting, if you know what I mean. But for some reason, it does. And I think that perhaps the fact that doing the small stuff in Starfield feels great and really holds my attention. It speaks to how well this game works as a whole thing. Like, it is a very giant, teetering structure of a game with all of these little bolted-on bits of shipbuilding and space combat and jumping and menus and all of that stuff. And if you look at them individually, you can pick holes in them quite easily. Each of them could be better and maybe, you know, has quirks in that Bethesda way. But when you add them all up, all of those different systems, the way that the quest system is structured with these different tiers of quest that encourage you to involve yourself with these other systems of the game, what you end up with is something very engrossing. Like, I'm not sick of this game. I really, really love going into it. And I've been thinking about why, and I think it is because of this possibility space, where there is just so much going on, and so much of it works well, the combat feels good, it's fun to go bouncing across a low-gravity planet to find a missing person. It's fun to talk to a local liquor store owner who tries to cut you in on his shady dealings under the counter. Everywhere you look, there's something new. You never quite know what it's going to be. I think that Radiant Missions in Skyrim felt very placeholdery and familiar and samey, and something about the sheer variety that all of the systems and mission tiers of Starfield engenders is a big enough space that I don't feel like I've seen the far wall yet, if you know what I mean. I'm having a little bit of trouble explaining this, but I hope that you're with me. I guess what I'm saying is there is so much to do in this game that you just never feel like you've seen it all, and that creates a hunger to keep moving forward into the game that I think is very rare. Even when I think about Tears of the Kingdom, which is another huge game with loads to do, there's only so much to do in Tears of the Kingdom. You're going to be building a lot of carts. You're going to be moving around a lot of sad Koroks to meet their friend. The sign stuff and little side quests. It's much smaller in scope than Starfield. And I think that's why I maybe tailed off Tears of the Kingdom, because I felt like I had seen the far wall of the game. Like I understood what was going to be in any given area when I went there. And that just hasn't happened with this game, which is very impressive. But anyway, to move on to the next topic in this little additional Starfield chat. I didn't talk about the space combat last time. And I think that's because when I first started the game, I just didn't engage with it. I found it a little fiddly. To lock onto enemies. I didn't quite understand all of the button presses, which I will get into why I think that is the case. And your ship starts off very underpowered, so I was losing at it a lot. And so I was trying to avoid space combat as much as possible, and it just wasn't on my mind. But that has turned around a little bit since the last episode. And that's because it just got better as the game went on, basically, and I felt more able to do it. So space combat happens sometimes when you have random encounters. So you jump into a new system, sometimes you'll hear a pirate voice crackling over the radio and they'll say, oh, you're dead, we're coming for you. You have to fight them off or escape, which is a bit fiddly, which I'll get to. Sometimes you get missions from the mission board that are like, take out the pirate ship orbiting Planet X. Sometimes story missions involve a little bit of space combat, so it's loosely optional at first, but you are going to have to involve yourself with it at some point. The story will make you do it, so you may as well get acquainted with it. So I started doing that once I had maxed out skill trees that I was really after, such as weight carrying, such as ballistic weapons, such as max health, lock picking, all of the essential stuff. I was getting skill points and wondering where to put them. And I found that maybe space combat was the way to go because I suck at it so bad. So I started putting a couple of skill points into my ship shields. So they went up by 20% and into my piloting, which increases maneuverability. And before you know it, the next time I was getting into fights that I would traditionally have lost, I was winning. And I thought, okay, so the story here is just that the base frontier kind of has weak shields. You have two health bars on your ship. The first is shields. Once they are gone, you start taking hull damage, which is like ship health, which you can replenish mid-battle, but then you're dead. When the hull integrity is zero, your ship will explode. You get a little death animation, and you'll restart at your last quick save. But it was amazing how much of a difference it made to have a more maneuverable ship, so you can turn faster, keep the enemy in your sights, and not lose their tail, have them turn around and start pounding you with their weapons again. And suddenly I was just winning those battles, and I thought, actually, this is quite fun. It's not stellar space combat. You know, I can think of even games like Chorus had good space combat, and that was a primarily vehicular space game, so you're only ever in a ship. You're only ever traversing and fighting. So that whole game was focused on having good space combat. As described, Starfield has so many systems that none of them are quite polished to that high sheen. But the space combat is serviceable. But once you can actually move faster, if you do manage to pick up alt ships to join your armada, which have better engine speed and that kind of thing, suddenly it really opens up and you realize the space combat is just shown in a bad light at the start of the game. So I've actually started enjoying it now. One of the things that I like in it is that as you open up the skill tree, you can do things like locking onto enemies and targeting, using the targeting system. So if you hover over an enemy ship in the reticle, when it's in range, you will get a locking animation with a target that hones in on it. When it locks, it turns red. You can then fire missiles that will home in on that ship. Even with your base ship, that is possible. It's a good way to take down a lot of energy, especially if their shields are already down. You take down their shields by using your laser. Once their shield is gone, you can hit them with missiles and cannon fire, take down their hull and beat them. But with the targeting system, you go into a VATS style mode. If you've played Fallout, you will know about VATS mode. It's slow motion combat where there is a turn-based element that creeps in, so it goes into intense slow motion. You can see the enemy ship maneuvering. You have this little window of time where you have the upper hand. You can select whether you want to shoot their shield generator, their engine, or their weapons. So if you pound them with enough firepower in the target locked mode, you can do things like take out their weapons so they are helpless, although they may then jump away. You can also take down their shield generator if their shield is too powerful. And you can take out their engines. And if you do this, you can board the ship. You can fight people in the ship, fight the pilot, kill the pirates, and then take the ship and add it to your armada. So that's where the whole space piracy thing comes into life. And I've actually managed to do this a couple of times now. Both times, I defeated a bigger, more powerful ship, but wasn't able to fly it because you have to up your piloting skills in the skill tree to be able to fly Class B and Class C larger, chunkier ships. So that's what I'm going to do next to, you know, open up this whole new section of game, even after what I think I'm on 70 hours now. And there is a space piracy aspect of the game that I'm still just opening up. That's kind of what I meant by not seeing the far wall earlier. The space combat has really opened up for me, and I'm looking forward to being able to do it better. I can use mission boards to actually seek out difficult fights, which is really cool. So that's in my hands, and I think I'm able to handle the random encounters a lot better. I did find a really cool ship that I got from a side quest reward. So I've been really enjoying the space combat, the VATS targeting system, changing out my weapons at landing docks so that they do more damage. I got a better reactor in my ship, so I've got more energy to give to the different systems of the ship at any given time. And as you get your head around all of these systems, which I do think are very clunky, it does start to open up. Just to touch on why they're so clunky, I think in the main game, you use, I think, down on the D-pad to use a heal kit, or at least the place that I have my heal kit stashed. You use the different shoulder buttons for targeting and firing, and some of that stuff isn't the same in the space combat. So I found that when trying to repair my ship, I might try and hit the heal button, and it's assigned to clicking in the right stick in ship mode, which is really bizarre to me. So it's making you learn a whole separate control scheme. And I think that you spend so little time in space combat and you've become so attuned to the main control scheme that it could have been a really smart move to try and bring those into harmony so that space combat felt natural and like more of a part of the game that you have learned and loved and enjoyed so far, rather than this strange mini game where you have to relearn your D-pad, relearn your controller. So I think that put me off a lot as well. So I don't know quite why they did the control mapping the way they did. But I have actually, you know, crossed the hill with space combat, and I'm looking forward to doing that more as the game progresses. Shipbuilding is actually a mechanic that I hadn't really used as well. It's another one that I had dodged, really. When you land at a landing strip, there is a ship technician at any landing strip that you can talk to. If you say, I'd like to view and modify my ships, you can also buy ships if you have a lot of money, but you can also view and modify your own ship. A model of your ship will appear that you can rotate, select elements, pull them off. If you do pull an element off your ship, you will get a flight check alert, so you have to have a ship that is flyable to actually make the changes and confirm them. You can pull things like gun turrets off, move them around to different parts of your ship if you want to. I did this because I was trying to make more space for a snap-on point for a second cargo hold. I selected my cargo hold, hit Y to duplicate it. It wouldn't fit anywhere, so I had to jiggle around a few elements. Ships do have a lot of cosmetic stuff on them, though. They have, like, carapaces and hoods and wing covers. This is all the stuff that makes them look cool. So it's not much fun to have to ditch cool cosmetics to try and make space for a second cargo hold, but that second cargo hold is going to change the game for you a little bit. It will deepen your resource pool, let you store more guns and outfits, all of that cool stuff. But I have actually managed to successfully do it. I did add a cargo hold to my ship. I also managed to get a ship, finally, that has a shielded cargo hold, which means I can possibly start to move around contraband without getting arrested every time. But I will say that I do find the ship builder to be fiddly and cumbersome and hard to understand. Even frowning at it and looking at all the key prompts and stuff, it took me ages to find out how to rename a ship. It's hidden in the flight check, and it's just a tiny little prompt saying press X to rename, and it is hidden. I don't know why it's not in the main menu. I think that the whole shipbuilding UI is really, really, really clunky. It's like God of War Ragnarok clunky. You just can't find anything. And so I've been put off that so far, but I will say that some folks have managed to make sense of it. Maybe people that are using a mouse and keyboard, to be honest, and they've been making things like the Millennium Falcon. I saw someone who made a yellow American-style school bus, which was really funny. So people are using the potential of this shipbuilder. I've just used it in a purely functional fashion so far and relied more on upgrading my ship and tweaking the ones that I have. But I do like that the shipbuilder is there. It is a fun thing. There is also a more usable element of it, which is literally just swapping out cannons and lasers and missile launchers for more powerful versions. So you can scan what each merchant has, look through their list, see if you can upgrade anything. And I did that a couple of times. I upgraded my laser, upgraded my ballistic cannon, and it really, really helped. That's one of the things that made space combat fun. So even if, like me, you have found the ship builder to be cumbersome and fiddly, I think that it is worth trying to invest in better weapons, a better shield, and getting yourself a second cargo hold at the very, very minimum. And that will do you well as you progress through Starfield. And yet another system to do with ships is that you can hire crew. So in bars around the system, you will find people sitting drinking that you can talk to. You can see that they have different skills, such as level 2 robotics, level 3 assassination. You can hire them if you want to, and then bring them onto your ship. There are 4 or 5 in each bar in the system, and there are many, many bars. I never really hired crew members because I wasn't sure what they would do. I guess you can use them as companions, basically. As far as I know, they don't actually add to your ship's stats or anything like that. So I think maybe they are just companions for hire. But you start off with so many companions. You have Andrea, you have Barrett, you have your robot Vasco, your trusty robot Sam Coe, the cowboy guy. So you've always got companions on hand, but you can bring these ones with you if you want to. I did hire one crew member, however, that I thought I would tell you about. He was just the funniest guy. So in one bar, there's a guy called Mickey Caviar. He has a New York accent. He's like this thick Brooklyn kind of accent. He's a chef. He is a douche. He is balding, he is vain, he is like a rubber-lipped food critic turned celebrity chef who's like, don't you want to hire me? Of course you do, boss. And I was like, I absolutely have to hire this guy, he's just too hilarious. So I've had Mickey Caviar with me on my journey around the star system, and it turns out you can talk to them after a while. They will sometimes give you stuff, they'll sometimes just give you money, so it does pay to have companions on board, but they also will slowly start to tell you their life story. And there are so many of these people. They're just random NPCs that most players will never see. Mickey Caviar turned out to have a 6-minute life story that I played through live on stream, just cracking up the whole time. Mickey Caviar cracked me up so much. Such a funny story. If you'd like to see that, I clipped it out and made it a highlight on my Twitch channel. So if you want to see me cracking up, listening to the ballad of Mickey Caviar, you can do that on the Twitch channel, twitch.tv/gamingintheWild. Maybe see me playing this game again as well. But if you have so far ignored hiring crew because it seems like a waste of money, I would recommend if you meet someone whose personality you find intriguing, or someone that you just think seems like an interesting NPC, hire them, and you might get a great piece of additional story content. I did say that I was going to talk about base building as well, but honestly, that's the part of the game that I've interacted with least so far. You can, when you are on planets, you can use your scanner to reveal seams in the ground of rock or mineral or gas. You can go into a base building mode, drop an outpost, and use resources that you have on deck to build things like extractors, cargo holds, as I have described, that will beam materials to different landing strips in different cities. You can set up turrets to fight off local wildlife and spaces and so forth. You can make an inhabitable space and assign crew members there. So if you have a load of crew and companions, you can assign them to a base. And you can actually build a substantial home base here. It does take a lot of resources, and with the inventory cap that I moaned about so much last time, I've been ditching and selling resources just to clear weight space for more looting. But you do need the resources quite heavily to invest in base building. So it's not something that I've spent a lot of time with so far. But if I do end up doing a roundup, if I actually manage to finish this game one day, if I get to end game and manage to do more base building, then I'll come back and talk about it again. And with that, I think it's time for the spoiler warning. I'm now going to talk about some spoilers in the main story, everything but the ending. So the Constellation questline. I'm going to talk about the UC faction quest, another one that I have not wrapped yet, but I've been pretty deep into by now. I'm going to talk about an artifact mission called Entwined that was maybe the best single mission I've played in the game, or one of them. And I'm going to talk about the Mantis side quest, an optional quest that you get early in the game. So if you don't want to hear about any of those things, now is the time to drop out. I will say thank you for listening. I will say, if you'd like to come and talk to me about this game, you can find me on social media as Gaming in the Wild. If you'd like to see me playing this game, I'm on Twitch, also as Gaming in the Wild. And the Patreon does exist, so feel free to come and support the show. There's a link in the description for that. And for everyone who is hanging around, I'll be right back after this. A good chunk of music there in case someone is listening whilst they are driving or cooking or dealing with something in life, just to give them a bit of extra time to turn off the podcast and not accidentally be spoiled. And that has happened to me before. I had my hands covered in dirt, I was gardening, and I couldn't turn off the short game podcast fast enough. So I left a little bit of extra music there. So the first spoilerful thing I'd like to talk about is the Constellation quest. This is the Explorer Society you join at the start of the game. If you have played the game already, you will have no doubt found out what they are all about. They want to find a bunch of artifacts scattered in temples around the universe. Pretty predictable main quest, I would say. It feels a little familiar. They use a space station called the Eye to track them down. You can visit the Eye to get coordinates of other temples to go check out. You have to assemble all of these artifacts, and they don't know quite what they are for, but they want to find out. You find out pretty quickly that what these artifacts are for is that they create a gateway called Unity that leads into multiverses. And in every multiverse, in every different shadow of the universe that you're in, or every parallel version, there are versions of you, there are versions of the other Constellation characters. And whoever manages to pass through the Unity becomes kind of the winner of that particular universe in the game that the Starborn are playing. They become Starborn. They become a universe traveler, a traveler between universes. And one of the big twists is that there are two Starborn that you will meet, these shiny helmeted alien aggressors, one of whom seems to be somewhat peaceful, one of whom will attack your settlement and cause a lot of trouble for you. I think they're called the Emissary and the Hunter. And you have to mediate between them and pick a side, ultimately. And one thing that I found interesting was I was talking to a friend about this, and I said, have you met the Hunter yet? And I hadn't in the Starborn storyline, but I had noticed this black-helmeted guy, Boba Fettish, standing around in bars in different planets and different systems, and I talked to them, and I had conversations with this person called the Hunter. They engaged me in philosophical conversation several times, and then I saw them again on Aquila in a bar and we talked again. So you can actually talk to the Hunter way before they intrude into the story and try and wipe out Constellation, which I thought was really interesting, especially given that my friend had missed that. So it's kind of cool that the Hunter is watching you as you collect artifacts. He's curious about what you're going to do. And you get involved in this whole Starborn story. And as we are now in spoiler territory, I guess I can talk about the powers. So when you collect artifacts, you are directed to temples. These are optional. But if you go to them, you will be bestowed with magical powers, alien powers, whatever they are, unity powers. I have found most of the powers to be a little underwhelming, actually. I experiment with it every time I get a new one. I think I'm up to like 10 or something. The only one that I have really used a lot is Void Form, which is one that turns you temporarily invisible, a little bit like armor that has the chameleon ability, so that when you crouch, you can go into a stealthy invisible mode. This one allows you to just be invisible for about 30 seconds. That has had useful gameplay ramifications for me. I've used it to steal, I've used it to assassinate, I've used it to do things that guards wouldn't like when they're looking right at me. You can just whack on Void Form, disappear before their eyes. They won't say anything. Steal something, they won't see you, even though they're looking at the spot where you just were, and then walk right out of there. So Void Form has been very useful. I guess most of them are meant for use in combat. I have used Gravity Well as well, the first one that you get, or at least the first one that I got. I don't know if they are randomized in some way. That creates a gravitational field in front of you that will make enemies float away. So that has been useful in a pinch. If you are mobbed, for example, if you're backed into a corner, there are three robots shooting at you simultaneously, Gravity Well can give you a little bit of breathing space. Those are triggered by pressing R1 and L1, and you can only have one equipped at once. You can switch between them in the menu. I also noticed there's a dash, but it's not very good dash. There is an oxygen bubble. I haven't found any utility for that yet. And there is quite a lame magic projectile, which is less good than your guns, so why would you even bother? But it is interesting that these Skyrim-y kind of skills have been incorporated into the game. And I did enjoy the arrival of the Starborn. They were mysterious aggressors with their futuristic technology. It was interesting to me who they were. It was enough to pull me along through the Constellation quest. Being attacked by them at first was interesting, but they seemed pretty easy to kill mostly. So they haven't been too much of a hindrance or too much of a foreboding aggressor, at least. They've been pretty easy to pick off until the Hunter arrives, and the Hunter is basically unkillable. In the sequence when the Hunter arrives and attacks the lodge, I emptied all of my best ammo into him that I keep for special occasions, the Ashtar Tamer missile launcher, the AA-99 advanced machine gun. Realized after a while that he's just going to keep reappearing, so you just run past him and get to your ship, and that's it. Which was a bit of a shame because I wasted all my good ammo and I'm still building it back up. But it did lead through to that big multiverse plot of the game, which I quite enjoy. It's a little bit malarkey-ish in some ways, but it is engaging enough. I enjoyed the sequence where you will visit NASA back on Earth, full-fledged NASA fantasy there. That was really enjoyable. It had a zero gravity portion, so I've been doing bits of story, but it hasn't really been where the fun is for me. And I guess I haven't seen credits yet because I'm worried that after credits you can either revert back to an earlier save or you just have to move on into New Game Plus. And I think I want to complete some of these faction quests first because I'm halfway through them. Don't want to lose progress or anything like that. I don't know what New Game Plus is yet, really. So maybe I'll complete it in the next week. We'll see if I can complete the UC and Freestar quests. Then I think I'm going to go for credits and I will do Ryujin and the other big one, Red Fleet, at a later date, maybe a New Game Plus or something like that. It really is just crazy to me that after 70 hours, I'm still talking in this way of having quite so many things to do on my Starfield shopping list. As we are now in the spoiler zone, I'm also going to talk about the UC faction quest, or at least the part of it that I have done. The UC faction quest, I think, puts a lot of people off. It's got space cop vibes that I've talked about before that I think no one wants to really engage with. Why be a space cop when you can be Han Solo? And it starts off boringly. You will do a flight test in a simulator. You will sign up and you're on a path to citizenship in New Atlantis. But that's where it gets good. The mission that you are given is your first Vanguard mission. It's to go and investigate a science colony that has gone quiet. And this is one of the best scripted sequences in the entire game. I couldn't believe it when I got there. I was creeping down into this this science installation. I found bodies, the music changed, it was dark, it was raining, and the tension was ramping up. And it's the first time you encounter a Terramorph in the game, this huge alien. You meet one person who is alive in the base, and they tell you that if you turn on all the power outside where the Terramorph is roaming, that the turrets will activate and that you can act as bait and run through a narrow alleyway and have the Terramorph chase you and be carved up by the turrets. It's absolutely terrifying. This was some Dead Space level heart-pounding stuff. Absolutely loved it. So I'm sad that most people that I've talked to haven't actually done that because they just don't like the sound of joining the UC, which I understand. But I really do recommend doing it because that alone was good enough. But from there, the plot launches into a grand story about the legacy of Xeno weapons, that is the Terramorphs that were invented as a military weapon. You'll get involved with testing, you'll get involved with searching for them, you'll meet the scientists that invented them, and it will go to the very top of the United Colonies. You'll be talking to cabinet members, you'll be doing missions for the president, all very highfalutin, but pretty fun. I would say that this quest went a bit soft in the middle, a bit too many go find this guy, go kill this guy, now go pick up this thing. I would like it if it was a bit more compact. There is a bit of filler in here, but for the first mission alone, this is really worth doing. And the second mission too, which I described last week, where you go down a Martian mine, very cool stuff. The next one I have here is the Mantis quest. This was a quest I got, put into my log, forgot all about, and skipped until someone in Discord told me about it. So thank you, Call Me Steam, for reminding me about this one. I searched through my mission log and I had the quest ready to go. It's called Secret Base. If you've not played this one, play it. Don't listen to me talk about it. It's fun. So the Mantis quest is, there is a mysterious figure, like a Batman meets Boba Fett, kind of criminal slash vigilante called the Mantis, and they have a secret base somewhere in the universe. The slate shows to you that the spacers have found the base and that they're going to go and rob it. So you go to the base, you find a lot of spacers, you find a lot of dead spacers, because as they have been trying to get into the lair of the Mantis, they have been carved up by traps and devious security systems and deadly robots. You will find their progress, you will find how far they got, you will see their splattered corpses, you will find their communications and read about how badly it has gone for them. You will also find notes from the son of the Mantis, who has been trying to get into that lair on the instruction of his mother, who is retiring. It's a whole separate story thing. This was a really fun base. It was quite involved combat, which I liked. There were quite a lot of enemies. One of the only times that I have felt like I was in danger, when I'm surrounded by robots and spacers all pounding away at me at the same time. So that was fun. The traps were fun too. You have to use terminals to untangle the traps and try and get past them. And then there's a guy that tries to double-cross you as well, and he was funny. He ended up... actually, the guy that tries to double-cross you, he's a random spacer that you find who says, take me along, I can help. You do so, but he ran in front of my gun when I was shooting a robot, and so I just papped him straight in the back of the head and killed him entirely by accident because he was a maniac who ran into my gunfire. So I went back and watched what happens with him on a stream, and found that he actually tries to double-cross you and explode you, and in doing so, explodes himself. So there's a comedy ending to that little sketch. But the rewards for this were cool, man. Like, I love the Mantis suit that you get. It is an amazing, slick bounty hunter suit with great stats. I love that you get the Razor Leaf, an amazing ship with a shielded cargo compartment, finally at long last, and with great engine stats, good weapons. It's much more maneuverable than the Frontier, so that became my default ship straight away. And it was just a really good piece of Bethesda storytelling, where you go through a base and you discover a story between bouts of combat, and you are looking at the events of that story around you. It took me back to Fallout 4, the highs of that game, which were many. And I really think this is what they do best. So quests like the Mantis, quests like the UC questline, with the Terramorphs. This is really, really top Bethesda stuff. The last spoiler mission that I wanted to talk about here was Entwined. This is an artifact mission. I got it later on in the artifact mission. I think it was the last artifact that I had to find to build the armillary. This is a one, because some of the artifact quests are very, very easy. You just rock up to a cave, kill a guy, take it. Sometimes it's in a spacer-infested mine, but that's, again, it's just like a standard mission. There is one where you have to go and buy one in Neon with Walter. That was fun enough. I just talked my way through it, fine. There was a really fun one where you have to go onto the ship of this gangster baron, and you have to basically intimidate him into giving it to you by being this, like, overpowered, super violent pirate. I think it's supposed to be a moral quandary for you in the game, but it was just entertaining. And the last really, really good one was Entwined. This is where you come to a science lab that has one of the artifacts inside of it in an underground facility. It's a very clean, bright, well-funded, well-run, well-defended science lab. You talk your way inside, but as you're walking through the lab to speak to the director, you shift into a multiverse, another universe, which is a nightmare version of the lab. The music changes. There are giant cockroaches attacking you. There is slime all over the wall. The place is half exploded. The bodies are everywhere. And then you shift back into the brightly lit space. And it was really, really eerie, really, really alarming. And the whole point of this mission is that you are shifting at first accidentally between the two worlds. You do meet a survivor, the sole survivor, in the parallel slime-covered world, who tells you there was an explosion in his world that he could not stop, that killed everyone but him. Back in the other world, you learn that he actually died in the multiverse that you were in. And the fun thing about this mission is that when you get to the artifact, by shifting through worlds to get through locked doors or collapsed tunnels, you have to shift and shift and shift. In the end, you can do it intentionally. So it's a world-shifting mini-game, a one-off mechanic that's only in this one mission. Again, peak Bethesda. And at the end, you can choose which world survives. So whichever world you retrieve the artifact in and shut down the machine that is causing the shifting will be the one that becomes canon for your universe. I chose the unfucked up one. So I chose the brightly lit lab. I decided to let all of their scientists live. And in doing so, I condemned that heroic sole survivor to blink out of existence. Very, very cool mission. Just absolutely S-tier video game stuff. Absolutely thrilling mission. I was so happy when I finished that one. So I think that's four different missions now that have given me that full feeling of just having my mind blown by how good they are. So again, this is another good review for Starfield. We've passed the 1 hour mark now. I have more notes here, but honestly, I think I'm going to save them. I think that's enough Starfield chat for this week. So I will come back to this game, hopefully for a wrap-up post-credits talk, maybe with a guest next week. Then again, maybe I'll just finish it and move on, and it'll be about another game next week. Maybe this is the last you'll hear of me talking about Starfield, but I have to say, somehow I doubt it. So for the third week in a row, that was Starfield. So that's our episode for this week. Hope you enjoyed it. Third Starfield week in a row. I'm absolutely loving that game, of course. If it is the only game that I play next week as well, then I will talk about it again. I'm curious to talk about other people with it too. There have been some great commentators out there. I've watched a lot of Starfield content and really enjoyed a lot of it. So if I do talk about the game again, maybe I'll bring someone in for some endgame spoilers and just to talk about it and get some different perspectives on the game. But maybe I will move on. I do also have all of those cool games that I talked about. I have Chance of Senar. I have Noor, Play With Your Food. It seems like a nice, short, breezy game that I could perhaps bash through and talk about. I have Mythforce to try. I'm still playing the Cosmic Wheel Sisterhood. And I have The Pale Beyond to get into as well. Although I think I'm going to save that one for the deep winter, just to get the full winter vibes. But it's time for me to stop talking, I think. It's an hour and 8 minutes long, this episode now. If you would like to support this show, please do so at patreon.com/gamingintheWild. Link in the description for that. You can find me on Twitch, where I'm streaming Starfield sometimes, or social media. I really appreciate reviews, ratings, shares, retweets, announcing the show. All of that stuff really helps. And thank you very much to my 50 patrons. We did it. I'll be back next week with a new episode. Take care of yourself and each other, and bye-bye for now.